Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
There must be things in our DNA that prepare us for how to do this, you know, that so many people would respond in the same way and have the same experiences, and at the same time feel like this is the most unique experience that's ever happened.
On today's episode, we are joined by Stephen Sexton. And as you're going to hear very soon, I definitely fangirl like crazy because
yeah, you do a, bit.
A little bit I do. Stephen is a writer and a poet, and his brand new book, If All the World and Love Were Young, is out actually today. Today is a different day than you're hearing this, but it's out now. And it's an incredible collection of words, poetry, and language. And it is based around the world of Super Mario Brothers, which is a very surprising thing. If you've seen the cover of the book, you know that famous pixelated font that is burned into our memory from playing many, many hours of these games. And Stephen has explored grief and the loss of his mother, who she passed away in 2012, and in this collection he delves into that world and what and losing her and what life was like, and it's a very beautiful, powerful collection, and it was so wonderful to have him on with us.
I think what's lovely is that I don't think, as he explains, it was intentional that this was going to be basically a memoir in one way to his mum and how he remembers her and the connection between something simple like a childhood game or a favorite toy, so to speak, as we all had, and his mum were connected.
And like he said, he started off really to explore Super Mario Brothers in kind of a light way, not something that I don't think he, as he says, didn't anticipate that this was, that grief was going to come through, and it has. And I think for the people who are, who may go on to read this, there are some extremely powerful passages in it, even one that Stephen reads at the very end of the episode where he talks about cancer in a poetic way that I've never really heard before. And both of us, of course, the tears. I was looking over at you. You were looking, you know. So he, it's a beautiful episode. It's going to a place we haven't gone yet, really, in terms of poetry, talking about the use of language and loss. So yeah, here's Stephen now. Today's guest is the Antrim-based poet and writer Stephen Sexton. If you haven't heard his name before, you are certainly going to hear it a lot in the future. In recent days, his debut book, If All the World and Love Were Young, has been quoted as a new modern classic and a poetry debut fit to compare it with Seamus Heaney. I have spent the last week reading through these and they are remarkable. It's a beautiful collection of work. So congratulations.
Sasha, that is really kind. Thank you so much for having me here. It is a delight to be here talking to you. I really appreciate it. I don't know what I do with those accolades, but they mean a lot. It's extremely valuable, and you know, people have been so kind. I'm very grateful.
Do they make you feel uncomfortable when you hear people, like, now that it's out in the world and it's there and people are getting the chance to sit with these? Does it make you uncomfortable when you hear kind of...
It doesn't make me uncomfortable. I mean, but, you know, I find myself doing all these defense mechanisms. You know, it's like the book is being compared to Seamus Heaney's debut book. You know, it's
which
is
big.
Which is really big, which is really big. But, you know, I'm kind of excited that it's out. I mean, I've been working on it for such a long time. And I guess the nature of this kind of publishing means that things take a long time. So from something I started in about the summer of 2015... It's been a good number of years, so I'm really excited that it now exists and other people can, and I hope will look at it.
It must be something bittersweet, though, because obviously your mum is such a huge part of it. When people talk to you about how much they enjoy it, is there part of you that feels sort of sad and a little bit sort of uneasy with other people's enjoyment of it, if that makes sense?
It does make sense. Not entirely. I'm certainly aware of that. And one of the things that I most recently have found the difficult part is thinking, that's kind of a stray thought, you know, how am I going to explain this to her that I've written this book? And then I think, oh, wait, I don't have to do that. Mm. And it's kind of this really strange moment that even, you know, I guess when you're not thinking properly or you catch yourself wandering off, that thought comes in. But also thinking about what other people who know her or, you know me are going to think about it, because I felt in order to write this the way I had to open myself up in a way that I'm not really used to. I mean, I had to be frank in a way that I wasn't really used to. So it's there's a lot of exposure involved, I feel.
Was it therapeutic? Was it a way of getting whatever was inside out without sort of having to go in a chair and talk to somebody in a quiet room?
I don't think of it that way, because I didn't set out to do this. I didn't set out to write this kind of book. I thought I was writing a book about Super Mario. I thought it would be kind of fun to, you know, to sit down and write a book about Super Mario. And as I started doing that, I realized that I couldn't write about Super Mario without writing about my childhood. And I couldn't think about my childhood without thinking about my mother. Mm. And you know, it took me by surprise that that's what I was doing. I think on a subconscious level, I knew what I was doing. I thought I was trying to have a joke. I thought I was trying to write about a video game. So I'm as surprised as other people might be that it's actually a book about grief and how to understand it, and how even something that was an object of joy and unconnected becomes changed, you know, in that really big orbit that grief has. It somehow manages to change the past. Which surprised me. So I think that's an impulse.
One of the things I read about grief only in this last week, that I think we read about it a lot, we talk about it a lot, obviously because of the podcast. So there's a few things I haven't seen that really struck me, but one of the things was, no matter how it affects you, and it affects everyone differently, no matter what, it changes you. And that is the truth that is underneath it all, is that it will change you. Yeah. No matter how, it could be very different for everyone how that manifests itself, but it will change you. I guess I would love to just start and find out about who your mother was, and her journey, and just who she was to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things, and I guess maybe a consequence of grief too. And I was talking to a friend of mine recently, perhaps something that you guys know too. My memory has gone funny.
Yeah, you know,
when I think about this, I think of months that are missing. I think maybe as much as a year that's missing, where I just can't remember what was happening. I mean, one of the things that I guess is important to me is that, you know, someone's life isn't dominated by how it might come to an end, you know, which is, that's the most emotionally potent bit perhaps, but that's not fair to that person, you know. She was the person who, among many other things, bought me and my brother a Super Nintendo sometime in you know, 1996 or 1995. You know, she worked for a long time in the civil service. She was somebody who was responsible for, I guess, foster children and negotiating those relationships, I think, with parents. And, you know, I was quite young. I mean, I was 23, I guess, when she died. But, you know, one of the things that I feel is missing is I feel as though I didn't have many years of adult conversations. You know, I didn't get to know her as an adult.
Is that something that makes you feel sad?
Because
you don't, you know.
And if there are things I need advice for, I could have asked, you know.
Yeah.
But it's strange, you know, you get to understand decisions people have made or things they have done in a totally different perspective, you know, from a child's perspective to an adult's one. I miss that. I miss that that's there, not there. But I suppose what I want to do with this is praise and preserve, you know, in this strange way. The video game I spent a lot of my childhood in. So this book becomes a kind of mnemonic where I'm trying to install her memory into this game so that when I go back to this game, she's always there. You know, and you know, by focusing on it with such intensity, I'm trying to change the code of it in some way.
Do you ever think about her buying it? Because as a parent now, I think about how much joy there is when you buy your child something that's important to them, or something that you hope will be important to them. Like my daughter, we gave her a dollhouse a couple of weeks ago, and it was the feeling that we had of getting ready to give it to her and having her see it. And a Nintendo was a really expensive thing to give a child, and especially in the time you're talking about, because that's probably around the time I got one too. And it was a big deal to get one. Have you ever thought about what it felt like for her to go get it and to...
I mean, I have a little bit, and you know, it's strange there. I guess we were maybe a moment ago, we were talking about memory. I don't think it's possible that I could remember this, but I have a distinct memory of exactly what happened. You know, I remember her driving home on a Friday evening with this in, you know, with a big box in the back seat. I remember that, but I distrust my own memory. I can't, I don't see how I could remember this so vividly. But, you know, I know that her mother had died not long before that. So we had ended up going to, you know, she wanted to work, my dad wanted to work. So we were with a childminder, you know, after school during the summers. And they had one of these that clearly we got obsessed with. And I think in retrospect, there was this, you know, her mother had died just a year before that. And I imagine, you know, again, I wish I could have asked her about what that was like, you know. You know, I in retrospect, she clearly was still grieving that, you know, at this time. And I should say my grandmother had been our childminder, our sort of caregiver. Yeah. So when she died, we had to go to somewhere else. And I guess all this stuff was bound up.
But you must have been grieving for spending so much time, particularly with your grandmother. There must have been a huge amount of grief for you.
Possibly.
As well.
But, I mean, I suppose that was 1995, so I was seven or so.
Yeah.
So what I might have understood, I'm not sure. I guess it's more of a...
It's a different process. Feeling.
It is.
Yeah, and it comes out, because I have a seven-year-old, it comes out very, very differently to, I think, how maybe an older child would process it. When your mum got sick, how did that all manifest itself?
Again, like some memories are absolutely distinct, you know. I remembered vaguely, she'd said she was unwell and was going to the doctor. I got a phone call one Monday afternoon, I think, you know, saying it was my dad phoning me, which he doesn't often do. My mother would phone me if there was something I need to know, saying you should come home if you can come home, and sort of wouldn't say anything else. And I don't know, I don't know if you've ever felt like you have another sense, but somehow I knew exactly what was wrong. I've no idea how I knew exactly what
but
was
you
wrong.
You know before they say it. It's a gut.
I knew exactly what it was. And, you know, at that time, I think my impulse was to be extremely ruthlessly practical and to say, well, you know, if there's going to be a treatment for cancer, that's a good thing, right? You know, that's positive. There's nothing we can do. So that's what happened. There was radiotherapy and chemotherapy, all the while me saying, I'm certain this, you know, these people know what they're doing. They know how to do this. And I think that was intense. And it was, you know, maybe there's the dignity of it that's a hard thing to think about. You know,
did you find it a sort of a limbo time because you don't know what the outcome is going to be during the treatment? Did you find that sort of disconcerting because you don't know whether you're feeling I should be preparing myself here or whether I'm just going to be optimistic and she's going to beat this? And
you know, I was both of those things. I was optimistic when I was speaking to her, but at the time, I guess with these kind of illnesses, I was doing my grieving then. You know, that's what happened. I went straight into that, which is in some ways unfair because the person's right there.
You know
how do you do this? Or
I think sometimes you start grieving without actually realizing it.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
The minute you hear the words cancer, that in the back of your head you're going, you know, your heart sinks and you go into that grieving process without even, you don't acknowledge it. It's only afterwards you realize that.
I think so.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to register it. You know, I wasn't sure. I think you're entirely right. I think I was doing that at the time. But you know, there was some treatment. She had to go in for surgery. That was done. That was scary. But it was successful, I guess. And there was, you know, a period of remission after that. That was wonderful. We felt we'd, you know, got away with something extraordinary. And then shortly after, things changed again. But that was over a period, all in all, of probably 4 or 5 years. Again, I can't attest to how time was actually working.
That it is could have been, the memory thing is weird.
I mean, I have like, dates, but they don't make
blur.
Sense.
No.
I think, and I've heard hopeful things about that memory, that they do come back once your brain starts to kind of recalibrate a little bit. But I agree. I mean, it's taken me a long time and I still think that things are very patchy. Especially, I find things are very patchy before my parents got sick, like long before they got sick is all muddled, and I can remember the illness quite vividly and their death, but before it, everything got really like And I think it's a response. When people are sick though for a long period of time, there's a stress that never leaves. And you know, it's like we talk a lot about grief and how that feels afterwards, but in an illness there's a stress. It's like your body is and your mind is, you know, that can be so hard for a long period of time. How did you feel your body dealt with that?
That's a good question. I do remember that tenseness. I mean, at exactly this time, I mean, I guess she did die in 2012. I started doing a master's degree in creative writing and poetry, 2011 to 2012. So during this time, I was sort of psychologically elsewhere. You know, I guess I actually felt kind of bodiless, if that's a thing. Yeah. You know, because part of my imagination was doing this, you know, work that I really loved doing. The other kind was emotionally charged all the time. And I don't really remember
It's like that thing, like after the event, when you go out with friends and you're all with your friends, you're sitting around, but you're not really there. You're somewhere else.
Absolutely. You know? And I felt that I had been somewhere else. For, you know, I was present, but I was somewhere else too.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for a safe haven to express how you feel, share articles, photos, and memories of your loved ones, join the Grief Encounters Facebook group, a place for support, compassion, and empathy for those grieving.
So writing started to play a role for you. When, like, I mean, I guess, was this something that was part of you from a very young age, or is this something that sort of became...
Certainly, at that I realize I've realized only recently that how crucial that 1 year was in my life. I mean, it was the first time I was feeling utterly creatively fulfilled, you know, with this and meeting a lot of people and sharing all this time with like-minded, enthusiastic, careful, kind people. But it was also the year that my life got split into two bits, you know, which is a fundamental experience. I remember being asked to write poems as a child at primary school. But I think that was busy work. I can't imagine what we were supposed to be doing. You know, I was a teenager.
And did you enjoy it, though?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, no, I did.
Other kids can be, oh, yeah.
It was
but
kind
then
of like
the ones that really enjoy it.
It was like a puzzle. You know, it was setting, you know,
make the words
setting
work.
Up rhymes, you know, which is fortunately something I've moved away from. But there was this feeling of, of puzzling and playing with language and making this happen. Then there were the difficult teenage years where we have more feelings than skill or sense.
Well put.
Yeah, so there was a lot of verse during that period, but nothing serious. And hopefully all of it has been entirely destroyed. It wasn't until...
I'm so glad my son's not a poet.
So it wasn't until, I guess, university when... I was around more people who were doing this and encouraged to do it, that I started taking it very seriously.
Did your mother have a relationship with language? Because you're using it in incredible ways. You know, you have... I'm sorry, I'll be a bit gushy. I'll go back to the question.
You.
But did your mother have any relationship with language? Was it anything that came from her at all?
I don't think so. You know, we didn't have a lot of books in the house. You know, I remember there being a copy of Treasure Island that I refused to read for some reason. I have no idea why. But we didn't have a lot of books. My parents didn't read a lot. My dad did a lot of crosswords. But I wonder where it comes from. I mean, they're from... I suppose the generation of people that left school at 14. I mean, I think my dad left school at 14. I think my mother left school at 15, maybe. And you go and get a job, you know. And I guess reading wasn't a tremendous part. They always read the newspapers.
Yeah.
But the idea of fiction or poetry was certainly not a part of it that I can remember.
I think words and grief and having the bravery to kind of go there. It's actually a really difficult thing to go there and put it down on paper or put it down and put it out there to the world. There is something in it. And yet it's interesting because the minute you do it, and especially if it reaches a large number of people, you get such a tremendous amount of response back. Everyone we've had on the podcast who's done anything like that has had a tremendous amount of response of people because I think we all need to talk about it. That's why we decided to do this in the first place. How do you feel about kind of like you said, you didn't set out to write about grief.
I didn't.
You didn't set out to be asked to be on this podcast.
But I'm delighted
you know,
that I am.
Those things, like there's things, it's a sort of a, like a special place to be. Mm. And it also there's a responsibility to it as well. Does it feel like something like by exploring grief and doing something and not intentionally doing it, is that kind of a strange place for you to be in?
It is. And it, I find it kind of exciting. I don't know how the language of this book works, but I still hope that it was kind of exciting. Like despite its content being unhappy and full of grief, I wanted it to be said in a way that was, you know, that I might use joy to describe sadness, which seems like a kind of paradox.
I mean, we've said that in nearly every episode.
Have you? Yeah.
That you need to laugh and there has to be some, you know, I think in nearly every conversation we've had, there's been some sort of a laugh somewhere along the line.
You know, it's so hard to find those laughs, but I know how important they are.
But it sort of is. And I mean, do you feel that sort of will help people as well? I mean, have you looked at it from that point of view, that your book could potentially help people who are in the same situation?
You know, that's a lovely thing to hope. I hope it could. I hope it could. And it's interesting. I mean, I wrote a lot about elegies and grief and how this works. And there's so many things that people do, that people have been doing for thousands of years with this kind of writing, and kind of by accident. I mean, like, the idea of language is a tremendous thing, and, you know, the language we use to talk about the dead or to talk about death. I mean, one must not speak ill of the dead, right? But I mean, that's a, you know, that's a code that is in our language, you know, that we're not supposed to do that. I'm sure, you know, I remember reading, I'm sure you know of, you know, some tribes in various places who have particular relationships with language where, you know, if a member of that tribe dies, no syllable in their name may be spoken again. Mm. You know, and just like language and grieving and loss seems so intimately connected, that in a huge way.
It's a real thing to struggle with. My mother's anniversary was a couple of weeks ago, and I every year I write something to help me. And sometimes I do something with it and sometimes I don't. And this year I wrote something about, not about her being sick, not about her dying, but something about us when we were very young. And I didn't send it anywhere for fear that someone might feel like I was stepping over a boundary by writing about her. And not even in a negative way, but just writing about her without her permission.
Yeah.
Even though, it, you know, she was my mother and it's a sacred kind of relationship. And I would, but I was too afraid to kind of put it out any further because I was trying to protect her. I know, you know what I mean? Yeah. There's such a complication in that kind of thing.
I think that was a threshold that I really felt myself crossing when I was writing this. I was, you know, she's not the sort of person who would have wanted this kind of thing, you know, so I had to make a call thinking, is this my experience? Am I doing this right? Am I doing this fairly? Am I being loyal to it?
But I think that's, like, I think, like, realistic, I know what you're saying about, like, maybe she wouldn't have wanted it, but, like, she would have wanted you to be brave and she would have wanted you to use this talent that is so incredible, how you needed to do that. Is it okay if I read one of these?
Would
that be okay? I'm going
to
give it a go. Just because we were talking about if it helps people. And I will tell you now that I felt immediately upon reading this. And this is what is so interesting about doing this kind of work, is that it may not even be in any way about grief or loss. But for me, this
spoke. You do find sort of grief in nearly everything.
I found it in for me. This is Choco Ghost House. And now there's this pain in my side like a bird in the holly tree, like there was something on fire. Look how the rain clouds have lifted, like a bird in the holly tree, there one moment and gone the next. Look how the rain clouds have lifted. I'm thinking of a storm in Spain, there one moment and gone the next. I can't forget the lightning, though. I'm thinking of a storm in Spain and us on the wet balcony. I can't forget the lightning, though, forks flashing again and again, and us on the wet balcony playing card games with the damp deck forks flashing again and again. The huge trees came down around us, playing card games with the damp deck, power lines toppled like ship's masts. The tourists all ran in the streets like there was something on fire. Power lines toppled like ship's masts, and now there's this pain in my side. Like, I love it so much. It's going to stay with me forever. I think the line, I can't forget the lightning, though, and it just floored me. Like, I just started crying. Like, I just loved it. Are you able to, like, look at these now, kind of step back and be able to look at them in any kind of way? Or are they still so part of you?
again, kind of both. Yeah. Kind of both. I mean, there were moments when I was writing these that were very, very hard. Mm. I mean, so, you know, I was defending, I was pretending and kind of defending myself a little bit. That's what the video game thing is helpful for, you know, that...
Is that like a front?
Yeah.
It is, yeah. I'm, you know, I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about the video game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just talking about this.
But there were times where I find myself saying things I didn't think I was able to say, which was surprising to me. Mm. And as soon as I felt myself doing that, I knew I had to do it. Mm. You know, I had to do it as much as I could. Mm. I had to be frank about it, which was hard. I mean, that maybe as you were describing, I mean, that's a memory of long before anything. That's being on holiday.
Actually, like,
you
I'm
know.
Just back from Spain, and I know those
the storms you get sometimes.
And the balcony is always really slippy as well. And I could just actually picture where we would sit and
like looking at
obviously, with the book being out and being published, you've done quite a few interviews and things like the podcast. So your mum, I'm sure, has been brought up quite a lot.
Yes.
Which mightn't have happened for the last couple of years. Do you find suddenly, like, talking about her again so much in such a short space of time, does it make you feel like she's sort of back in your life a little bit? That she's there a little bit?
A little bit. I mean, I guess my hope with this book was I was putting her somewhere that will last, you know. Mm. And if I want to go back there, you know, because I came to distrust my memories, you know. I worry about 10 years from now, had I not written about it, would I have lost more, you know? Or 20 years, would there be things that that would be gone that I couldn't access again? So I feel as though I'm trying to maintain, you know, to keep these things going. As far as that presence goes, I mean, that's one of the fundamental things, I suppose, in this book, that idea of, you know, the happy memory, the ways in which one could kind of get lost in a fantasy, a hopefulness, or the reality of saying, no, she's gone for good. There's no, you know, there's my imagination, there's my memory, but there's the reality of being gone. So that tension's always happening here. I mean, the title, I don't know the last time you've been reading 16th century Renaissance poems.
Yeah.
But, you know, this title comes from a poem that is a rejection of idealism, of a rejection of a pastoral, lovely landscape. You know, that things change, people are lost.
Mm.
So I guess the thing that I struggled with in the writing of it is, how do I admit this? How do I move away from this?
Mm.
You know, and not that the Super Nintendo should be switched off metaphorically and literally, but it felt necessary, you know, to be able to confront this.
But I think we do all have that sort of, like we were talking at the start about people changing in different ways when they grieve or whatever. And we do, I think everybody, when they lose somebody very close to them, does develop some sort of front or some sort of, it's almost like an alter ego in one way, where they're sort of like, okay, I really have to go to this thing tonight, so I'm putting this Venetia out tonight and we'll hide this Venetia behind her and we'd be grand for 2 hours. And it is sort of like the Nintendo. It's like the Nintendo has to go out tonight even though you don't want to.
Sure.
But, you know, you'll hide behind it, and that's a way of getting around it.
I just like the idea of being seen hiding behind it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the sort of, you want to be the public version, but you want yourself to be seen behind it, you know.
Also the starkness, you kind of, in reference to the title of the book, like, it sometimes helps me a lot to believe in, like, a real starkness of the whole thing, that it is.
I
actually find when people try to placate or soften it or change it or try to attempt to say that it's a different thing than it is actually very hurtful. I think the starkness is actually, for me, much more useful. She was very sick, he was very, they were very sick, they were in pain, they were not well, and now they're gone. And I know that's
shit, and it's and that
it's very I think, because I think a lot of times you hear that from people who have not lost, because they do not want to believe that it is as stark and bleak as dark as it is, because if they believed that, then how would they go on the next day thinking I might? But there is a black, dark starkness to it all. And that can be a weird thing to kind of just go, but empowering.
I, you know, I feel the same way. Like, I wanted, I think just acknowledging the fact of it. And I mean, at the time, I don't feel guilty about it necessarily, but you know, at the time when you know we knew the event was hours away or minutes away, like I remember thinking, be aware of this, like think about this, like notice everything. And I've forgotten most of that, but I remember thinking, you know, you're going to do this once. Many people are going to go through this. Yeah. Try to remember what this is like.
But you don't
remember. Yeah. I don't remember.
It's just. Yeah,
you know, but that thought came into my mind at all. You know, I sort of worried I was preparing some kind of artistic research even at that time, but I was thinking like,
but it's a service to the world to like remember. It is actually we've talked about like one of our guests talked about something very very difficult. He talked about his brother's mouth being open when he passed,
goodness, yeah.
and like seeing that. And anyone who maybe has seen someone die knows that happens. And it's a shock to a lot of people. Like, oh my God, this looks so different than I'm really afraid.
Yeah.
But he said it out loud. And I think things like being able to kind of remember those things, it is a service to other people. Stephen, I wanted to ask you, do you have any, when you can check your memories against, do you have people in your life that you can say, was it that way?
That
you
do?
Yeah, I mean, my brother, you know, was there, but I guess we were both going through the same thing. Mm-hmm.
Did you both react differently? Did you both...
I mean, I think so. I mean, it's not something that we talked about a great amount. I mean, he's 2 years younger than me, but I kind of felt like it was my responsibility to be the business person, to assure him that everything was going to be all right, you know, to say that this is what happened, this is how we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. The next 3 days will be hard, but this is how we do it, you know, and again, consoling myself by being practical. I mean, I knew what I was doing at the time.
Did you break then at some stage? Did you hold that sort of keep it together and then... At some point, did it just all come out?
As I was saying earlier, I felt as though I'd done a lot of grieving to start with years before. And I felt relief. It's one of the things that is a hard thing to feel when she did die. I think about a year and a half after that, some evening I was sitting on the sofa and just, lost something. That I don't know where that came from, but I couldn't really have been responsible for where it was coming from.
Yeah.
But I mean, it took a long time. There's a there's a delay. There's no right way for it to happen.
No. And memories, like you said about your brother, like even if you can check them off someone else, there is actually no real truth in either of them. My sister and I had a really great conversation about this a couple of weeks ago, because we have very different versions of what happened, our lives. Completely. And we're a year and a half apart, so we're not even that much in an age difference between us. But we have very different interpretations. And actually, we've only just recently come to a place where we're really open to hearing the other person's version. I think now that we're a little bit older, we can say, okay, what did you think? And not just shut it off and say, that's not what happened. This is how it happened.
Yeah.
And kind of say, oh, really? Like, is that how you saw it? And how it's almost like a version of you in the mirror or a photograph. It's like, what is the real thing that happened? All you can go on is the pieces that you can pull together.
And
it's personal as well. I mean, it's a person, it's your memory, it's your childhood memory. I think
it's such a, like, it's a physiological thing as well as like a psychological one. Like there must be things in our DNA that prepare us for how to do this, you know. We respond in the that so many people would respond in the same way and have the same experiences, and at the same time feel like this is the most unique experience that's ever happened, but also knowing at the same time that it's not, that it's fundamentally the same as this, you know, the experience other people have had.
No, it's interesting you say that, because you do, that's exactly, and you sort of, I think maybe, especially when you're a young person experiencing grief, and it is something that you feel that you're on your excuse me, that you're on your own, but then with the podcast, we have a Facebook group and everything. And it's very interesting for me to see comments from sort of younger widows as well that come out with the same, they have the same feelings. It's like the second anniversary is much worse. But it's really interesting to see. And it makes you realise that, A, you're not on your own. You're not unique, which, you know,
it's a hard thing sometimes, but
it's a hard thing to accept. But it gives a sense of community and a sense of belonging.
Absolutely.
In one way.
I felt it was fairly unique. But on the other hand, you know, I remembered a friend whose mother had died when we were at school and suddenly felt I'd understood her in a way that I hadn't in the intervening years.
Did you feel almost guilty?
A little bit, why couldn't I have understood this? And I suddenly understood her in so many ways. I mean, regrettably, when friends have in recent years lost parents, I felt I know how to do this. And, you know, and
you know what to say.
And could talk to them and be kind of be frank with them in a way that I wouldn't ordinarily be frank with them. But that kind of community thing matters. And, you know, I guess I was thinking, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of copies of Super Mario have been sold since 1990. But there are all these people out there who either have lost their parents or haven't yet. And I thought, well, what? How do you offer them something? Mm-hmm. How do you say, like, there is consolation? You know, I mean, I'm thinking of that friend, you know, who didn't have any of her friends to help with it because they just couldn't understand.
That has to be so isolating at that age when you're just like feeling like you're alone.
I mean, I'm thinking 15, 16. Yeah. You know, I guess all times of life are pretty difficult, but that's a difficult one.
Do you feel almost a sense of duty that, because you're now understanding to a certain degree what you're going through, that you now do, through your words, need to try and help other people who may have just gone through it or could be about to go through it?
It's hard to know how to want to do that, but I want it to be available to them. I want it to be open to somebody. I don't know if a book like this could have helped me at the time, but I would have tried, you know. Yeah. And to talk about it frankly, to talk about it, you know, kind of fantastically. Maybe one of the things that has come up is, I guess, these kind of poems are often involved journeys, right? There's this idea of your public self that goes into your private self for that moment of mourning, and then you come back again. Hopefully you come back. And I mean, this is a journey. There is this journey into this digital landscape of all these kind of strange flowers and plants and creatures. And then you come back and ideally what you come back with is the story, and you do this. I mean, this is what you guys are doing, right? You've gone somewhere and you've come back, and now you're telling people, this is what I got when I was there. Do you want to talk about
it? It's a great way.
You know, like, but that idea of a journey, you know, of an adventure is one way
nice
of thinking.
It's a nice way to look at it.
Stephen, do you mind, as we finish up, can you read us, you're choosing something from the book?
I would love to.
Thank you.
Let's see. Yoshi's Island 2. Pixels and bits, pixels and bits, their perpendicularity. One of the worlds I live in is shallow as a pane of glass. The threshold of the window sets a frame around the holly tree, wild funguses slimy with dew and toxicity. The rubies of holly berries sing on the branches the robins hide among, and the veins of ivy vines wind around the slumping trunk and boughs, slow berries in the blackthorn and the carcinogenic bracken. Groundsels loiter along the low dashed wall the daisies loll about. One summer's day I'm summoned home to hear of cells which split and glitch so haphazardly someone is called to intervene with poisons drawn from strange and peregrine trees flourishing in distant kingdoms. We take the air in the garden, bitter with berries and mushrooms too toxic to eat, where the grass bows in an unexpected breeze.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks.
The best of luck, Stephen.
Thank you.
With the book. I mean, I think it's something amazing that you have now. I think that is your project. Some people set up trusts. Some people organize marathons. Some people do painting exhibitions, whatever it is, or set up, you know, whatever it is they do. You've written your book, and I think that's a lovely way to remember your mum.
Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.